Jesse Hernandez is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas. Death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Hernandez by injecting him with massive doses of drugs made to save lives. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the killing by Texas, which has carried out more than one-third of all executions in the modern era. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, legal analyst Jim Skelton, and criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley and Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Professor David Garland, author of Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition. The Execution Watch begins.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us here on Execution Watch. Again, the state of Texas is planning to put to death Jesse Joe Hernandez by the end of this broadcast. I'm Marlo Blue. I am substituting for your regular host, Ray Hill, who is on assignment, doing one of the things that he does so very well. Mr. Hill will be back, hopefully, soon. And until then, you can always follow his wonderful adventures on Facebook or any place else you need to find Ray Hill. Joining us tonight is going to be Jim Skelton, of course, Susan Ashley, and Larry Douglas. Thank you so much for being here tonight. Let's first go straight to Huntsville with Gloria Rubeck, who is standing by outside of the death house. Gloria.
Hi, Marlo.
Hello. A sad occasion, but thank you for being there with us.
Oh.
Can you describe the scene out there and what's going on at this point in time? Gloria? Is Gloria...
Sorry, I had accidentally hit mute. What's happening here in Huntsville is that the execution is on. The witnesses have gone across the street from the administration building into the death house. I must have missed the media because they go first. But there's actually a relatively large group of us here tonight. There's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10... About 15 students here from Strake Jesuit High School in Houston. There's people here from Spring, Tomball, Houston, Huntsville. A woman from Germany is here. She's studying art at UT in Dallas and just showed up here.
So there's still strong international interest. Of course, we've had some very famous people who have been witnessing lately. Do we know who are going to be the witnesses inside?
I don't. I was just looking at the people going in, and I would assume it is Mr. Hernandez's family because they look to be Latino, but I'm 75 yards away, and so I'm not positive. But no, there's nobody from the family out here that can give us any information.
And of
but there was, you're allowed 5 witnesses, and they had at least 5. Perhaps a couple were, there was more than 5 that just went in, so perhaps a couple were spiritual advisors. But you know, Marla, what I find so friggin' ironic is that Mr. Hernandez's case was set for a conference before the Supreme Court on the 30th. Today's the 28th. Why they didn't grant a stay, I don't know, because I didn't think they had posthumous conferences on cases, but maybe they do.
Well, Gloria, we will discuss that a little bit more here with Jim and Susan and Larry and get down to a little bit of the bottom of that. And, of course, we will be calling, you will contact Elizabeth when you see the, all right.
I will do that.
Again, we will.
And the other interesting thing I think it's important for listeners to know, there was a really big brouhaha created by the prison system that came out in The Guardian today about the, apparently they did a Freedom of Information request from TDCJ on how much drugs they had left, and for some reason the prison system just spouted off like blathering idiots, accusing this group reprieve.
Reprieve out of London, UK. Yeah.
Yeah. Of wanting to cause violence, and they just really went off. And I thought, how
more violent than killing someone?
Yeah, and here they are with this assembly line of death, well oiled here, and they're talking about a group that wants to stop killing, that they're violent. That was pretty bizarre. But of course, there's nothing logical about the death penalty. So,
well, Gloria, thank you. We're going to be coming back to you in just a little while.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye, Marlo.
Again, we have been speaking with Gloria Rubeck. She's the founder and leader of Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, and you can always go to their website, abolitionmovement.org, for more information about that. Now, of course, she is our reporter outside of the Death House in Huntsville, and we depend on her to be our eyes and ears as the witnesses come out and the execution has been called to an end. Also there in Huntsville is Dave Atwood. He is also a founder of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And Dave is there with a different kind of group. Dave, thank you so much for joining us. It's Marlo.
Hi, Marlo.
And
glad to be here.
I hear, again, a very sad occasion, but I hear you are ushering in the very next generation of advocates coming in with a bunch of high school students. Tell us about that.
Well, the straight Jesuit social justice class from Straight Jesuit High School is here. There's about 10 students. They came up. They've been here about a half hour now, and they came up, and we had a little talk on the death penalty, and they had a little prayer service. And now we're all standing at the corner by the prison waiting for the next steps, which is going to be probably people coming across into the prison for the execution. And but anyway, I think that it's really admirable that their teacher, John Fay, brought them up here to see what's going on here firsthand, not hearing about it secondhand in the newspaper or any other way. They're right here on the in the middle of it all, and so I'm very happy to be here with them, definitely. I mean, nobody wants the execution, but at least that they're concerned, and they're knowledgeable, and it bodes well for the future, I think, in terms of abolition of the death penalty.
Absolutely. And are they scared?
No, I don't think so.
Are they seeing this?
I don't think so. I think they know. I mean, they've learned about it ahead of time, and we had a good discussion of what happens. And so I think they're, no, I don't think they're scared. I think they're, you know, anybody would be a little bit of in awe of this walls unit, you know, and how big it is and what's happened here with all the executions that have happened here. Anybody would be in awe of that. But, no, they're a bunch of young, brave men as far as I can see.
It's a very solemn time. Is there anyone from that group that might like to speak to us on the air just to give us their reaction to what's happening?
Well, let me see. Just hold on. John, you want to say anything?
Again, we are talking to Dave Atwood. He is live outside of Huntsville, outside of the wall. He has escorted a group of students from one of our local high schools there. They are learning firsthand what protesting or about the death penalty. Of course, the death penalty is a big question here in Texas, and these are advocates from different groups for Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement who are teaching the next generation. Mr. Atwood.
The Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Okay.
Well, here's a student. Just say a few what it's like being here, and you know how do you experience this, and what it means to you. Okay. And introduce yourself. Okay.
Hi, my name is Brent Lanier. I'm a senior at Straight Jesuit College Preparatory in Houston. It's very moving being here, actually. You know, to actually see this going on and all these people out here out to abolish the death penalty, it's just very moving to me. And I've always been against the death penalty, and I feel that this is making my conviction stronger, and also convictions of my friends and classmates as well.
Brad, thank you so much for joining us and spending time. I appreciate it. Please tell Mr. Atwood we appreciate him as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We are back in the studio live here at KPFT 419 Lovett Boulevard with a group of legal analysts. Let's start first on some facts of the case, Susan Ashley.
Okay, the facts of the case are that a lady named Misty Leverett, who had two small children, she had a 10-month-old baby named Carlos and a 4-year-old girl named Melody. She moved in with Jesse Hernandez and his wife, Mary Rojas. Jesse Hernandez and Mary Rojas had two children, Joshua and Gilbert. On the day of the assaults, Misty went to work around noon. She left her two children in the care of Jesse Hernandez and his wife, Mary. Mary later testified that after Jesse went to work around noon, that she stayed home with the children, and Jesse Hernandez and their boy, Gilbert, left and they went out to run some errands. When Jesse Hernandez and Gilbert returned about 2 hours later, Mary Rojas left for her sister-in-law's house, and she was gone for about 30 to 45 minutes. Mary testified that when she got home, she heard Hernandez screaming at Joshua. That's one of his children. She picked him up, and she took Joshua into a room that she shared with Hernandez. Mary asked Hernandez where Carlos and Melody were, and Hernandez replied that they were sleeping in the next room. Mary then went into her room and relaxed with Joshua. Later, when she heard Hernandez preparing a bottle, she told Hernandez she was going into the room where Carlos and Melody were sleeping. Hernandez instructed her not to enter the room and said that he was afraid she would wake them up. Apparently, Mary Rojas saw blood stains on Hernandez's shirt, and she waited until Misty Leverett got home from work to check on the children. Misty testified that when she arrived home, she went into the dark room she shared with her children, and she found Melody complaining that her head hurt. Mary and Misty Leverett took Melody out into the kitchen and saw that her head was swollen and had red splotches on her head. Misty Leverett decided to take Melody to the hospital. After they left, Mary Rojas checked on Carlos, and she noticed that his lips were swollen. She determined that Carlos was badly injured, and she took Carlos and Joshua down the street to her sister-in-law's house to call for an ambulance. When Misty and Melody arrived at the hospital, hospital workers asked Misty if she had any other children. When she replied that she did, hospital workers instructed her to return home and to get her son immediately. Misty testified when she returned home, Hernandez was alone, and that he told her that Carlos was at her sister's house. Misty asked Hernandez to take her there, but he refused. Shortly, a few minutes later, police arrived and informed Misty Leverett that Carlos had been rushed to Children's Hospital by ambulance. When police began investigating the assault on Carlos, they went to Hernandez's home. Hernandez had some outstanding warrants, and he was arrested and taken to the police station. A detective named Breedlove talked to Hernandez to get some general information and to inquire about the injuries to the children. The detective testified that Hernandez was not a suspect at that time, so he was not Mirandized. Hernandez gave an affidavit denying any knowledge of what happened to Carlos and Melody, and was later transported. Hernandez was transported to the county jail. After police spoke with Carlos's doctor and after police spoke with Melody, Hernandez became a suspect in the assaults. Detective Breedlove met with Hernandez, then read him his Miranda warnings and began an interview. Hernandez repeatedly admitted, then denied striking the children. The detective asked him about a flashlight found at the scene, and Hernandez admitted that he may have hit Carlos with the flashlight. Another detective took over the interview after Hernandez became upset with the first detective. And after talking with the second detective for about 30 minutes, Hernandez asked for an attorney, and the detective stopped the interview. A few minutes later, when the detective entered the room to take pictures of Hernandez's hand, Hernandez stated that he wanted to resume the interview. Well, Hernandez basically ended up giving a written voluntary statement, And in his statement, he admitted hitting Carlos and Melody because they cried for no reason and because he was upset over recently losing his grandmother and because he had a bad day with his wife. He added that he was sorry for hitting them, and there was nothing, and also there was nothing in the written statement about hitting Carlos with a flashlight. Basically, Hernandez stated that they were being bad by crying a lot for nothing, and that he exploded and hit them with the back of his hand, not realizing he was hurting them. Carlos, the 10-month-old baby, died approximately 1 week after the beating. The prosecution introduced evidence that Hernandez's right hand appeared swollen during the hours following the time when Carlos and Melody were beaten. Hernandez's wife testified that she noticed swelling on his right hand, and she told a police officer about it. The jury also heard testimony from the two different detectives who noticed swelling on Hernandez's hand. One detective who interviewed Hernandez testified that the back of one of Hernandez's hand was swollen more than the other hand was. Another detective who interviewed Hernandez on two occasions, once in the morning of the incident, then later in the afternoon, testified that he did not notice any swelling on Hernandez's hand in the morning interview, but he did notice swelling in the afternoon. Because Hernandez was jailed between those two interviews. Now, Hernandez's attorney asked one of the detectives on cross-examination whether the detective recalled being told by one of the jailers that in between the interviews that Hernandez was beat on the cell wall and was there causing a ruckus in the jail. The detective said he did not recall any such statements. Well, both the defense and the prosecution argued in their final arguments, they both made an argument about the swollen hand. Obviously, the defense argument was that it possibly could have been from him hitting the cell wall, and the prosecution argued, of course, that it was from beating on the children. Susan. And that's basically the facts of the case.
Okay, Susan Ashley, thank you for that report. Again, you are listening to Execution Watch. If you had tuned in hoping to hear uprising, Execution Watch is on every time that the state of Texas puts an inmate to death. Let's move on a little bit. We will have a featured interview a little bit later on with David Garland. Of course, we are still waiting for Gloria Rubick to call us in to say that the witnesses are coming out. Next, let's move on right now to Larry Douglas. Larry, let's talk about.
Just want to talk for a little while about the appeal, the direct appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas. The reason for having an appeal is not necessarily, well, certainly not to go over and relitigate the case that was already tried, but to look to see if there were any errors that were reversible errors mm-hmm. that were made during the trial.
Right.
And so what Hernandez's lawyers pointed out is that some of Hernandez's fundamental rights might have been violated. For instance, the claim was that the prosecutor made unpermitted statements regarding Hernandez's failure to testify.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way he constructed that was clearly a person has the constitutional right not to testify, and it cannot be used against him for any reason in the deliberation. And actually, the prosecutor is prohibited from speaking about a defendant's failure to testify. Well, in this case, the defense lawyer, one, as Susan mentioned, tried to get one of the jailers to admit that after the arrest that Hernandez was beating on the jail cell, and is trying to suggest that maybe that's how he got his hand injured.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the jailer never testified to that. And so then in closing argument, what the defense lawyer did was pointed out the fact that, wait a minute, you're talking about this guy has his hand injured, but it's not in the offense report anywhere. It's just nowhere. So he's bringing attention to that. So what the prosecutor did in response was to say that, you know, we brought proof on this issue, on every issue. They didn't. Where's their proof? Well, Hernandez's appellate lawyer uses that to construct the argument that, well, his concern about where's their proof, well, that proof had to have come only from Hernandez, and Hernandez didn't testify. Well, the fact is, the jailer could have testified to that. And so it's not necessarily an impermissible comment on his failure to testify. And that's what the appeals court based its opinion on. Said, well, no, that's not reversible error.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're appealing a case, you have to try to put in every single possible grounds for appealability. Well, that was one that failed. The other thing was the written confession. Hernandez signed the confession, but as Susan mentioned, the confession was he was given his warnings that he had the right not to make a statement at all, and he waived those rights. But then he asked for a lawyer. And so after he asked for a lawyer, then they've got to stop questioning him. But then later on, he says, well, now I want to talk. They didn't know what to do. And so after a little consulting, they decided, well, we'll go ahead and take the statement from him. And they had him write the statement out. So he writes out a statement. And under that set of circumstances, what the court decided was that the statement does come in. So and the final analysis, the actual written statement came. And now the written statement didn't have anything in it regarding Hernandez admitting to striking with a flashlight. But he had done that orally before the written statement was taken. So because he had made several oral statements before the written statement was taken, the court allowed those statements in, too. And over the objection of Hernandez's lawyer. Now, back up, Hernandez's lawyer did not object to the prosecution's argument regarding claiming that he had a right not to testify, impermissible final argument. But Hernandez's lawyer did object to the bringing in both the statement, which was overruled, and also the fact that the oral statements were brought in too. And the state used an evidentiary rule called the rule of optional completeness, saying, well, in order for the jury to understand the total statement, we've got to bring everything in. Not just the written statement, but also the oral statements. Mm-hmm. So those were brought in. The appellate lawyer says that was impermissible, but it came in anyway. And then finally, there was the evidence regarding Melody's injuries.
Melody being the young daughter.
The young girl, sister. The 4-year-old girl. There was a 10-month-old boy who died. And then the 4-year-old girl, okay, there were some photos that were introduced regarding her injuries. Now, there's kind of a catch-all evidentiary rule about all relevant evidence is admissible unless.
Right.
So based on that rule 402, the court allowed that the evidence of Melody's injuries to come in, the photographs to come in.
Larry, let me stop you right there for a moment, and let's go back out to Huntsville live with our reporter at In Front of the Death House with Gloria Ruback. Gloria.
Hey, Marlo. How are you?
Very.
Well, the execution has taken place. It's very somber out here. I think a lot of us thought that there was going to be a stay of execution. And as many executions as I've been to or protested at, it never is routine. It's
Gloria, can you even count how many executions you have been to?
No, maybe a couple of hundred. I don't know. I'm not sure.
It's amazing.
But every case is different. There's different circumstances. There's different situations for the person being executed. But it boils down to every time is that Texas is killing somebody, and they just don't have the moral authority to kill anybody.
Gloria, let me ask you, please, to describe the scene to our listeners who are not there. Be our eyes for a moment. Tell us what's happened.
There's a lot of us standing down on the corner. The building is called the Walls Unit, and there's a huge, maybe, I don't know, 25, 30-foot high red brick wall all around this prison, and the entrance to the unit is like in the middle, so we're probably 75 yards, and they've got yellow crime scene tape so that nobody can get up near
where the witnesses are going in. There's, because it was a Dallas case, I guess, which has more media than if they're from a little town, there seems to be a number of media people here today. Right now, there's a, I just talked to a woman from Switzerland who has a pen pal on death row. And I asked her if she'd be on the radio, and she said, I'm sorry, not only is my English not good, but I can't talk. This is the first time I've ever stood here while they're killing somebody. And I'm having a hard time just processing what's going on. There's a bunch of high school students who are still standing here, even though the execution was over about 5 minutes ago. Some of them are saying the rosary. Some of them are looking shocked. A few of them are talking to some of the abolitionists that are usually out here. It's a very somber scene.
Thank you, Gloria. Thank you for telling us. Thank you for being our ears and our eyes. We appreciate it, and we'll see you when you get back to Houston.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Again, we have been speaking with Gloria Rubeck. She is founder and leader of Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, and you can get more information about her group at abolitionmovement.org. Let's get back to Larry Douglas for a moment. I'm sorry to have interrupted you in the middle of your stream.
Not a problem. Clearly, cases involving violence, prosecutors like to put on as many gory photos as they can.
Mm-hmm.
And in a death penalty case, in addition to finding the person guilty, the prosecutor has to do enough to make the jury mad enough to kill him. And so in this case, there were photographs of Melody, the 4-year-old girl who was beaten. And they put on as many photos as they can get into evidence. And the courts, in this case, the court stated that because this was all one episode and that two children were beaten, that to have a complete picture, that evidence, the photographs of Melody's injuries, was also relevant. And as a result of its being relevant, then it would be admissible.
Mm-hmm.
There's a limit typically how many photos they can get in, but they got these in. And so these were the essentially what I've discussed were the primary grounds for error that the appellate lawyer brought up to the appeals court. And then so once these were brought up to the appeals court, after having reviewed them all, determined that there was no basis for reversible error, and the appeals court then affirmed the conviction. And then as he goes further and further along the appellate route, his defendant's possibility of getting something overturned becomes less and less, because the courts then begin to look at less and less of what happened. Okay, the appeals court is just a matter of, let's look at what happened in the trial court. And not that we can decide whether everything was right or wrong, but does anything that occurred in the trial court constitute error to such an extent that we can call it reversible error, saying one of its fundamental rights were violated?
Hmm.
And that's the limited scope of the appeal at the Court of Criminal Appeals level.
Again, we are listening to Larry Douglas give his analysis. Thank you so much for that, Larry. And you are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 89.7 in Huntsville, Texas. This is Execution Watch, the online electronic vigil, the only online electronic vigil that is here every time the state of Texas puts to death an inmate. For those of you who are listening online, overseas, internationally, thank you so much for joining us. We do appreciate it. Thank you for being a part of KPFT.org. Of course, executionwatch.org itself is the place to go for all information on executions. Let's go back to Jim Skelton now.
Well, I'd like to do one thing that kind of annoys me about some of our programs that we do. We're always talking about what happened, and we don't offer a lot of solutions. I'm going to throw this out to all three of you. Let's assume that you're a lawyer in this case, and your job is to defend him. And what the facts are real simple. There's no question you're going to probably be found guilty, because you had a man that, you may, everybody forgot to mention the fact, this man had been in prison once before. He went to prison for indecency with a child. He had a wife that testified in that trial, that an ex-wife, that he'd been mean and cruel to their children. So you got an adult man that beat up two kids, one 10-month-old and one 4 years old. One died from rather severe injuries to the brain. You also have evidence that his blood, the children's blood, was found on his shirt, and you got his statement admitting beating the children. And the reason they made a big issue out of his hands being swollen, this is evidence the prosecution used to show the beating was substantial, because I can slap a person a couple of times, my hand's not going to be swollen. Or for my hand to be swollen, I've got to do a considerable amount of hitting on somebody. That's why that was an issue. Let's assume you're the lawyer, and your job is to defend this man. And your job is to try to keep him. You're not going to get him off of it, because you've got a confession, you've got DNA evidence tying to him. What do you do, or what words do you say, or what approach would you suggest to take to keep this man from getting the death penalty? Let's talk about the lawyer's job in this case, because we can do all this talking we want to, and that doesn't help a lot. What can we do in the future if a case like this comes up again to assist somebody to figure out a way to keep him from getting the death penalty? Marlo, what would you have done had you been a lawyer?
That's a really incredibly good question, I'm saying.
So what would you have done?
I have no idea.
Okay, and Larry, do you think of anything you could have done?
Well, clearly, the objective is to keep him from getting the death penalty.
Of course. Guilt is assured.
Most likely.
Most likely, a confession, DNA evidence.
The first step is to try to convince the prosecutor not to seek the death penalty.
No, I'm talking about it. That's not going to happen.
Okay, well,
let's talk about the jury. How do you get a jury not to kill him?
The evidence against him is overwhelming, so you do just the opposite of what the prosecutor's doing. That is, the prosecutor's trying to make him mad enough to kill him. So your job...
How do you go about doing that?
In terms of getting the sympathy on his side.
Okay, get me a way to get sympathy.
Well, the first thing is the decision as to whether he takes the stand or not.
Should he have taken the stand?
I don't know enough about this case, but I'm not opposed in general to putting a defendant on the stand if there's something that can be gained from his testimony, including eliciting the sympathy of the jury. That is,
if he's
a sympathetic person at all. I don't know enough about him, but that's the first step, is trying to decide, is there something about him that I can have him express to the jury such that they will not kill him.
Susan, what would you have done?
Well, this is what I think what I might have done is, first off, what we can gather from these facts is that these people were obviously extremely broke. They had no money, because it says they had no water. Now, clearly Misty, with her two children, had just moved in with them a couple days before. We could assume that she moved in with her two children because she probably had no place to go. She was broke. Maybe she was, you know, obviously friends with them and moved in. So the whole group of adults with four children, we can pretty much say that they were pretty broke and pretty destitute. From that, you can probably go to the next step, that they were under a lot of stress. If you have four children, no money, and no water where you're living, my guess is you would be under a lot of stress. Hernandez probably was also under a lot of stress. What I might have done is looked at what his background would be, maybe had some type of psychologist or some kind of experts, maybe analyze the situation of how these people were living, what stress he might have been under, and then the children crying. He obviously, you could say, snapped and, you know, beat the children. So that's probably what I would do, is try to get some psychologist to analyze him, maybe some other experts that maybe have some expertise in people living under stress and how much stress people can take before they snap. And, you know, that may vary with individual, and it may vary with, you know, their background.
Okay. And I think also, I mean, along with what Susan's saying, in tailoring it in terms of how the special issues are structured. If he snapped, I mean, that sort of undercut some of the deliberate. I mean, it's just a deliberate.
Okay, let me tell you the key to this. I'm not jigging, but a whole bunch of cases. Let me tell you what you got to do in a death penalty case. Number one, people are going to think he's a monster because of his conduct. So number one, you've got to humanize him.
Right.
That's step number one. Number two, you've got to figure out a way to mitigate the bad facts. You can't change the facts. You've got to mitigate them. Let me make a suggestion if this would ever come up in the future, anybody listening to us. Years ago, there was a horrible case here in town in which two kids, both of whom had multiple sclerosis, they were in wheelchairs, and they had been adopted by a family who cared for them. And they adopted new, and they had multiple sclerosis. They were pretty like teenage kids, and they were down at Clear Lake fishing. Some guy pushed one of the wheelchairs off, both of them off, to try to kill the kids. He didn't even know them. He just didn't like cripples. Drowned one kid. Now, that's a horrible set of facts, just like this is a horrible set of facts. Here's what the lawyer did and what could have been done in this case. You're going to know pretty well that Hernandez came from a tragic background. So the first thing you've got to do is minimize those bad facts by trying to explain them. What you could do and what they did in that case is they claimed insanity, not because they thought they would win on insanity, but that providing the evidentiary vehicle for them to get in evidence about his tragic childhood. Because by calling a psychiatrist claiming he was insane at the time of the crime, you're going to lose that issue. But what you're going to be able to do is prove up the horrible background that he lived through to mitigate those really bad facts. And what you can do is use insanity defense, not so much to get an acquittal, but as a way to mitigate and to explain his conduct. And really, because you've got to give a jury emotion they can relate to. Right, everybody right. is related to being broke. And you should emphasize the fact that they took in. Now, this is generous on their part. This couple with two kids took in a woman who had to work as a waitress, and her two kids had they only been there a few days. They took that woman in to help her. Number two, people can understand if you're locked up in a small house with no money, not even running water, you got two screaming kids that are not yours, plus two more kids, and no money, you can understand kind of losing control. People can relate to that emotion. So the key you've got to do in cases like this is, number one, humanize your client. By humanizing your client, that means, as a general rule, you always got to put him on the stand. Just like, for example, it's easy to fire somebody if you don't do it on the telephone, if you don't look at them. But if you meet somebody face to face and hear them talk and hear them relate, you put them on the stand. Now, another suggestion I'm going to make to those of you who in the future have cases that have these horrible facts, if you're going to let your client testify, always give him some experience with testifying before he gets in front of the jury. Put him on the stand outside the jury to get him used to being cross-examined with the jury not being present. When you put your client on the stand outside the presence of the jury and let him testify, get some people in the audience. Make sure there's some people, especially women, be there who don't know him to give you their impression what's good and what's bad about him. You can, for example, we walk into courtrooms every day. We're at home in those. People who've never testified before, the first time they get the stand, if they're fighting for their life in front of a jury, that's horrible. They should have some experience ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So you put them on pretrial. And when you put them on pretrial, you have a ghost audience to watch them. And then you pick up on things that they say. For example, years ago, I defended a guy that was involved in some horrible murders. He looked normal to me. I sent some women to talk to him. Some female women are very perceptive about things. Every woman that I sent up there said, "Jim, he's got dead eyes like a shark." Mm. I couldn't see that. So you know what we did during the trial? We got in some glasses and tinted them so the women on the jury couldn't see his eyes. So when you put that client on the stand pretrial, have some people there to see how he's doing, to give him some practice, get him used to that. Also, if possible, you can't do it in death penalty cases. If possible, if your client's going to testify, have him go watch some trials to get used to see what it's like so he won't be so frightening and terrified of it. So the key in a case like this to save his life is to humanize him by him testifying. And by showing them, just not putting them up there praying for the best, give them some experience at doing though. Number two, figure out a vehicle to introduce evidence to mitigate those horrible facts. And in this case, you could use an insanity defense. Not to get insanity, but you can get in a whole bunch of evidence that the expert could rely upon that would show his terrible childhood and emphasize the following facts. Took in a woman to take care of those children. Here's a guy stuck in a house with two screaming kids, two more kids, and two women mothers nagging at his happy ass. And that would be enough to drive a lot of people off the brink. You've got to do that. And that's, in my opinion, the only way you can handle a case like this. I'm not saying the bar is wrong for not doing so, but I'm saying in the future, when we have these horrible facts, that's something to think about.
So you say that because they didn't actually humanize Jesse Joe Hernandez, he lost his life.
Well, you have a guy, he might have lost it anyway. I'm saying his better shot would have been if the jury could look at him. Because when you read those facts, the first thing you think is monster. Very first thing you think when you read these facts. And what your job is to a jury is to get the jury to relate to him as a person to person. It's not bad. It's not hard to kill a monster. If he's a monster, they're going to kill him. But you cannot have him just sit over there like a lump of wood and not humanize him. You humanize him by letting him testify. As a general rule, you got nothing to lose. What the hell can you lose?
Right.
He's given a confession
right. And
put him on the stand, but you help him know how to put his best foot forward. I'll give you an example. Years ago, I had a client that I was going to put on the stand that was jailhouse. Every other word was MF this, MF that, dude this, dude that. And I said, look, if you talk like a criminal, they're going to convict you. I said, here's how we're going to do this. I'm going to give you a Bible, and I want you to read one chapter a day out loud so I learn to improve your diction. If you say dude one more time, or if you say all this jailhouse talk or MF this, MF that, I'm going to break your blankety blank neck. I can do the cussing, you can't do the cussing. Real simple. You're on trial, I ain't. And I had grilled him for like 2 months. I had him reading the chapter in the Bible every day to practice his diction. You know what happened? He got on the stand. I didn't coach him to do this. He pulled his handkerchief, and I swear to God, he sounded like a Baptist preacher. I almost fell over, and we got an acquittal. And the jury told me that was a self-educated man. He got self-educated by reading a Bible I swiped out of a motel and gave him to read. He read a stolen Gideon Bible every day. And that I got him practicing to test because I knew he had to. Because what happens when you get nervous, you lapse back into a vernacular you're comfortable with. And so I didn't want him thinking like a crook and being like a crook. For example, if you have a client, then you've got to have women. Women are perceptive about things. I had a lady that I was defending on the capital case, and what we did, we brought over women to do her hair, do her makeup. And she looked real harsh. And what did we do to keep her from looking harsh? Put glasses on her face, some big horn-rimmed glasses, because believe it or not, in times past, juries have realized people with glasses don't seem to be as violent as people without glasses. And so that glasses softened that harsh look she had on her face. And we had women come over and look at her makeup and did makeup. We spent a lot of time just getting her propped up as a prop to testify. And you've got to do that in cases like this. You've got to humanize your client. You got to put them on the stand as a general rule because you've got nothing to lose in a case like this. And you've got to figure out an evidentiary way to minimize those bad facts. You can't change the fact he beat up two kids. Can't change that. But you can damn sure get a jury to understand, well, perhaps I could have done the same thing if I'd been in the same shoes, therefore we shouldn't kill him. That's, in my opinion, the only hope they had.
Well, it sounds like it was a long shot, and it didn't sound like something that they took. So,
well, it's, and again, that's like I say, it's always easy to quarterback. But the reason I brought that up,
even if it's with glasses, to make it look better in a silk purse out of that sow's ear.
The reason I brought this up is because so often in programs like this, we talk about everything the lawyer did, but we never offer solutions.
Right.
And all I'm suggesting, this is a possible solution for anybody who has a loved one that's going to go to trial, the things they've got to think about.
And this is not just death penalty cases.
No,
but
in any case.
Really any case.
Because the real key, Larry, people have visual images of what a crook looks
right,
like.
Right.
A flasher, you think of an old man in a tan round coat from behind with black socks and one of them sagging. That's what you see. When you think of a drug dealer, you think of Hispanic guys with jewelry around his neck. You think of a hijacker, you think of a young black kid. It's what you think with a hoodie on. That's what you think. So if you have your client coming into court, for example, I defended a guy who was accused of beating a man to death. He had a lot of scars on his lips. It looked like he'd been in a lot of fights. He had been, so we had him to grow a mustache to hide the scars. He had tattoos. We put a cast on his hand to cover the tattoos, because people associate with that. They get certain ideas.
Well, let's talk about association in, a little bit further, and if you don't mind, we'll switch cases here for a second.
No problem.
We were expecting to have an interview with David Garland, author of the most recently published Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition. Unfortunately, at this point in time, that's not technically possible.
Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about the Trayvon Martin case. And let's talk about association and clothing and basically walking while black.
As you know, Geraldo Rivera kicked off a big controversy. Geraldo Rivera is on a talk show, I think it's an ABC program, it's a Fox program. And he kicked off a big controversy. He is saying that he blamed the hoodie for being a part of it. He claimed that the kid was dressed up with a hoodie, and when you see young black men wearing a hood, you immediately think of gang member. Just like when you see, and frankly, it kind of annoys me to go to the courthouse, and you see these young black kids coming down with their pants around their ankles, and white juries see them. That makes it very difficult for me as a defense lawyer when I defend a young African-American, because they have that image of those kids that sit at docket call with their hats on sideways leaving the courthouse, because they look like thugs. And the problem is, if you look like a thug, they're going to treat you like a thug. And Geraldo got in a big storm because he said that part of the reason, in his opinion, was the kiddo was dressed up, that the first time you would look at him, the first thing you'd think of is gang member, mm-hmm. which automatically makes you a little bit more cautious. And automatically, for example, if you're walking down the street in Houston and you see two young black men dressed up in suits looking like Mormon preachers, you're going to not be feeling intimidated, but you take those two young black kids and put hoodies on them, drop their pants down, let them put some hands in their pocket. Are you going to feel the same way toward the two young black men walking toward you? Would you, Marlo?
I have to tell you that in my life, size matters. And if those two guys are bigger than me, I'm walking on the other side of the street, no matter what they're wearing.
Your comment on that.
Well, I think Geraldo just blew it, but that's not the first time Geraldo's blown something. I don't know everything about the case, and I haven't been following it that closely, but I do understand that it appeared that things were going as one would expect until the police called the state's attorney, the prosecutor, because they had decided to charge him, George Zimmerman with manslaughter. And the prosecutor then determined that due to the stand your ground law that they couldn't charge him, and I think that's a total misreading of the law, and it just makes me wonder about that particular prosecutor. From what I've seen, from what I've heard, it would seem as though the only way to stand your ground.
But Larry, you're bypassing the question. The question is the dress a hoodie part of it, the thing that Geraldo said, does that make it, do you think there's that kiddos have an obligation or parents have an obligation to have their kids not dressing like thugs and looking like thugs when they go to the courthouse?
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, some of the things that people do coming to the courthouse, I'm talking about black and white.
Yeah.
It just makes no sense. But in terms of walking down the street,
let me ask you this. Would you be more frightened of a young black kid wearing a hoodie and his pants down low like a bebopper as opposed to one in a suit looking like a Mormon preacher?
I wouldn't be afraid. I wouldn't be concerned.
You wouldn't make any distinction between the two.
Well, it would make a distinction, but I wouldn't get necessarily frightened by it. But the fact is, in this country, you can walk around looking any kind of way you want to.
Well, I do.
And that does not give anyone the right to confront you.
That's not what they said. They just simply said that is a contributing factor. They never said it gave them a right to do it. They just said that was a contributing factor.
Okay, but then the law has to be applied. And it should not have been a contributing factor. And the stand your ground. The only way that I see this applies in this case is
standing your ground basically means you don't have to retreat.
Right. But even in Texas, I mean, this is not a Texas case, but you can't arm yourself and go and seek an explanation, and then seek to avail yourself of the self defense.
Yes, you can, but you can't, as long as you're not illegally carrying a gun.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Hmm. But in this case, Trayvon Martin, from his perspective, there's the guy stalking you. And the way I read the Florida Stand Your Ground law is Trayvon Martin could have killed George Zimmerman and availed himself of the Stand Your Ground. Whereas, and I don't know how the confrontation began, but if George confronted Trayvon after having stalked him, and you know a guy who's with a gun is coming after you, that gives you the right to stand your ground. Whereas I did not see George Zimmerman's ability to avail himself to stand your ground, at least not on a blanket standpoint. I mean, I would be glad if prosecutors on all of my cases started looking at defensive theories up front and decided how they were going to proceed on the case.
So you blame the prosecutor, not the police?
From what I have heard, the police had decided to file manslaughter.
The prosecutor's the one that changed it.
And the prosecutor decided, no, the way that this law requires
us not to.
And you're
saying the prosecutor's at fault, not the police.
And again, I wish prosecutors in my cases would consider defensive theories before filing charges.
Okay.
Will this start putting more light onto these laws?
I think probably so, because we have what they call we narrowed down self-defense in Texas a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. Then we adopted what we call the Castle Doctrine, which doesn't require you to retreat in your home. So we put an alteration. At one time, self-defense in Texas was really wild. As a matter of fact, years ago, we had what we called the Paramore Statute, that if a guy caught a man making love to his wife, he could kill the man and get away. It was justifiable. And if he killed the woman, strange enough, it wasn't. And we had a lot of these strange laws, and we didn't have a retreat law until, several years ago. And we've altered the retreat law to some degree, and it's called the Castle Doctrine, in which if you're in your home, you don't have a duty to retreat, because the way the law works in Texas is simple. It would be a different case if this happened in Texas. The law says, number one, in order to use deadly force, you've got a reasonable person in your shoes would have to perceive that you're going to get seriously injured or killed. In other words, if the assailant comes toward you, he has to be the aggressor. He has to be the aggressor to agree that a reasonable person in your shoes would fear of getting killed or seriously hurt. At that point, you have a duty to retreat if you can. If you cannot retreat and retreat's not reasonable, then you can kill somebody. That's the Texas law. It's entirely different than Florida.
Well, what happened with the Pasadena case that happened with the gentleman who shot the intruders?
Really quite simple. The jury thought it's okay to kill some burglars. I'm the grand jury. That's what you call equity. I hate to tell you this, but what happens, people, there is an old phrase.
And this is the Joe Horn matter, right?
Yeah, the Joe Horn. Well, I know the lawyer that took Joe Horn's case to a grand jury. There's that old phrase in Texas. It's been around for years, and there's still some truth to it. Mm-hmm. They say you can get more. Back years ago, they said you get more time for stealing a horse than you can for killing a man. The reason being, a lot of folks needed killing. There was a horse that needed stealing.
We like horses.
Well, I'm just telling you. The way that grand jury just felt like it's okay. If these guys are burglarizing houses, tough luck for you, and you ought to kill them. That's what the grand jury pretty well thought.
But the difference, though, is that Joe Horn did see somebody engage in a criminal activity, whereas...
But he wasn't under threat of being hurt by any of them.
If they came after him when he went
if
out...
If they weren't coming after him.
He didn't go out... But Trayvon Martin was not involved in any criminal activity.
We're not comparing the two. She just asked about Joe Horn.
That's right. And I'm sorry that I've taken us off track, because really and truly, we are here to talk about Jesse Joe Hernandez.
Let me tell you a little bit about something we haven't talked about. It was a big issue on the federal appeal. And you've heard a lot of talk about that in the newspaper. Let me tell you what the big issue is. And the Supreme Court just answered the question a couple of days ago. Okay, in death penalty cases, you have the right as a lawyer to claim that the lawyer is ineffective at trial.
As much as I'd like to continue this, we have finally gotten David Garland onto the phone. Mr. Garland, thank you for joining us today.
Hello, it's a pleasure.
You are, of course, the author of Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition, and a professor of law and sociology at New York University. Also, of course, one of the founding editors of Edinburgh Law Review. fascinating kind of things. I saw some of the testimonials on your book, and Supreme Court justices, you name it, you've got it going on. Why do you think that it is the capital punishment is being perceived in the way it is here in the United States?
So it's being perceived in a lot of different ways in the United States, and it's perceived very differently in Texas than it is, for example, in, I don't know, Minnesota. But the big question is really not how do people feel about capital punishment, because I think that public opinion about the death penalty is kind of strongly for and strongly against in most countries. I think the big difference with the USA is that our political system and the federal constitution have made it much more difficult to abolish the death penalty in the way it's been abolished everywhere else. And so local political majorities get to retain it in this country, whereas in most of the rest of the Western world, the national governments, the national elites have abolished it despite public opinion.
Jim Skelton, you've been reading his book. Do you have any questions for Mr. Garland?
One thing I want to mention, Mr. Garland, my name is Jim Skelton. I'm a practicing lawyer, and I have to read a whole bunch of law stuff that lawyers have written. I've got to compliment you. Most lawyers write like they've got a dull carpenter pencil on butcher paper, and it's illegible. And I want to first of all compliment you on an extremely readable book. And I'm always, one of my tests on reading things is whether or not a sixth grader could understand it. And I think you did a beautiful job of writing your book. And I wanted to compliment you on that.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Next thing I would like to ask you, I'm just curious about this when I was reading the book. Who did you have a target audience when you read the book, when you wrote the book?
You know, I had two target audiences. One were Europeans and non-Americans, who are just really deeply perplexed about the way that the death penalty continues in the USA. And people, my compatriots in Europe, I come from Britain myself, people regard the death penalty in the USA as a sign.
Mr. Garland, thank you so much, and I hate to cut you off. I appreciate you calling us in. We do appreciate it. We have to move on to the next show. Thank you so much for calling in.
You're very welcome.
That was David Garland. And a special thanks to everyone here in the panel. I appreciate Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, and Larry Douglas for your time. A special thanks to producer Elizabeth Stein. Ray Hill will be back soon. Also, thank you to engineer Doyle Odom. I am Marlo Blue. For all of us here at Execution Watch, thank you for listening. Uprising will be back in its regularly scheduled time slot next week. Next execution will be Bianca Adams on April the 26th. Join us then. Thank you and good night.